The theme of this episode of Rotcast is Rara Avis, which, as we all know, is Latin for rare bird. Before we go too deeply into wine and movies, I just want to point out a few rare birds. One is a fellow podcaster named Terry Frost. I listen to many podcasts. Many of them are film-related. I love movies, old and new. So it's really a treat to hear about a film I've completely missed. I can't remember exactly how I found Paleo Cinema Podcast. Probably through a promo, or maybe I heard Terry as a guest on another show. But I'm certainly glad I did find Paleo Cinema. Terry's show has proven to be a great source for me to learn about several great films that I wasn't aware of. So when he introduced his new show, the Martian Drive-In Podcast, and asked for help with artwork, I said to myself, I can do that. I'm very glad that he liked the logo I made for his new show. He was also kind enough to run a promo for Rotcast. So if you've just come to Rotcast from Terry's show, I want to say that Terry is a rare bird, and I hope you enjoy my show as well. I need to explain that this show doesn't run on a tight schedule. I ask for your patience. So far, we make about 10 shows a year. But maybe podcasting is like a muscle, and we'll pick up the pace. You can always find the new Rotcast program on vnostalgia.com. If you're like me, you also listen to a wacky show called The B-Movie Podcast. It's hosted by Vince Rotolo. Through his show, I found an old high school chum. Vince goes to a convention called Monster Bash, and it just so happens that Ron Adams puts on that convention. When I heard Vince mention Ron's name in connection with Monsters in Pennsylvania, I immediately thought, I wonder if that's my old friend. It was. Vince can do a better job describing the Monster Bash than I can. I'm going to play a bit of the B-Movie Podcast that Vince has given me permission to use. It's from his show number 210. I'll pop in every now and then to explain some things he's talking about, because there are several names you'll hear that you might not recognize. The first person Vince talks about is Arch Hall. He's a fellow who was once in a movie called Wild Guitar. I had never heard of that teen exploitation film until The Bash. Arch was there and he played with the Monster Bash Band, a rock combo of electric guitar, bass, drums, and keyboards.
All right, that's the contest. So now we can talk about the Monster Bash, which was really fun this year. This year was a really good one. And then that, I think it was Friday night when Arch Hall actually played, you know, his guitar with the band that they had up there. And I thought that was really good. He did a really good job. And I thought that was so cool how they were projecting the Wild Guitar on the screen behind the band. So you could see Arch real young there playing the guitar and then seeing him now.
There was a scene where his character's playing in the club and the girl's dancing, and the music he was playing just matched up perfectly with her.
That was in sync.
Martine Beswick was there. I got her to autograph my Hammer Glamour book. Yeah, she was in 1 Million BC fighting with Carolyn Monroe, and she was also a Bond girl. She was in Thunderball.
Yeah, she was also in Prehistoric Women, the Hammer film.
I think she was also in that Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, if I'm not mistaken.
I had never heard of actress Martine Beswick, but I had seen her photo on many Hammer horror items for sale. My wife and I found her introduction to the documentary about Ray Harryhausen very amusing. She's the epitome of the self-involved actress diva, a bit of Gloria Swanson. You know, she was ready for her close-up.
And got to see Rico Browning again. That's the second time I saw him up there. He still looks good. He's about the same every time you see him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he was sitting next to Julie Adams. It still looks really good. And I bought her new book, and got her to autograph that and got a nice picture of her. They had a like a life-size creature back there, so I got a picture of us in front of it. Looks like the thing's going to rip my head off.
Vince and his guest hosts are talking about Rico Browning and Julie Adams. These two actors appeared in the famous Creature from the Black Lagoon. Browning was the creature who takes a shine to the raven-haired research assistant, played by Adams. In the movie, the monster swims undetected below the heroine, matching her swimming stroke for stroke. I guess they've been going to conventions together for quite a while.
Yeah, my horror host, Chili Billy, was up there again. He's always there on Saturday. He still looks great. He's doing radio still. A couple of the Night of Living Dead cast, the cop from Night of Living Dead, and Kara that had the trial, all that stuff. Even John Russo was up there. I think he's the one that wrote it and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Well, those boys are all out of Pittsburgh, so it wasn't exactly a long trip for them.
Yeah.
Especially Tom Savini. Now, Tom Savini, he's a local person. He lives right in the Pittsburgh area there, so he never misses the Monster Bash, the Horror Hound, and some of the other events that happen in the Pittsburgh area. He was one of the presenters on Saturday night when they were doing the presentations that Martine Beswick came on stage, and like Tom Savini was also up there talking a little bit about the documentary before they showed it. So
I tell you, it was one of the best ones, I think, because, the different documentaries, the bigger movie room, and next year at that new hotel, that should be fantastic. Monster Bash goes to Mars, and it's in July. It's in July 19th and 20th next year. Bigger hotel, a lot more vendors. Should be really cool.
From what Ron was telling me, that they're going to have the vendor room is going to be three times the size of what that vendor room.
Wow!
I better start saving up now. Anyway, John Saxton's going to be there next year, man.
He's going to be there.
Robert Dix from Forbidden Planet and Butch Patrick. He's been there before. Donnie Dugan was a little boy and the son of Frankenstein. And so that's going to be cool. Veronica Carlson's back, so looks like a good one.
So the B-Movie cast and Rockcast both agree that the Monster Bash was both good and cool. Maybe I'll get to meet Vince at the next Monster Bash. This would be a good time to inform you that Rockcast has a couple of horror movies scheduled to be part of the chapter and verse quiz. They should be available around the end of October, and new horror pictures will continue till the end of series 3. Now it's time for another statement of the obvious. When we both were young and running around State College, Pennsylvania, I thought I knew this big secret, that focus was everything. If you keep one thing, one goal in mind, then you can achieve almost anything. Yeah, I might have even said as much for all to hear, but knowing this and practicing it are incredibly different. Once I contacted Ron, he was able to send me a DVD, which kind of caught me up rapidly about his life. It showed me his wife and daughter and told me about Monster Bash. I tried to tell Ron's father, who was there helping out, that my work also does a conference every year for social studies teachers. And there's a staff. I'm part of that staff. And even though we're a small organization, we put a lot into the conference. Lots of vendors help us put on that event, and it's a big deal. I tried to say to Ron's father that it was impressive that his boy does the same thing for people who enjoy monster movies. To me, Ron is a huge success. He's done it. He's taken the thing that he's focused on since childhood and made it into a living. His whole family is right there too. It did happen with Ron Adams and his family. He is a rare bird. Okay, I have one more rare bird to point out before we launch into the juicy truth. You might have heard the voice of M24 if you've listened to previous Rockcasts. M24 is a lovely woman who works with my wife. She is a listener to the show and she likes wine. She lives in nearby Virginia, and through her endeavors as an outstanding artist and photographer, She's come to own a case of wine from a very exclusive Virginia winery called RDV. She has graciously donated a bottle for our Juicy Truth segment. M24, if you're listening, thank you.
And now, the Juicy Truth.
This Juicy Truth is going to be a little different. The wine we've picked is going to be pretty hard to get. I don't think it's very fair of me to review a wine that people can't lay hands on, but I think you'll find this interesting enough to forgive the fact that this bottle of wine is somewhat exclusive, a rare bird. Let's describe the label right off the bat. Three birds perch on the front of the label. They are overlapping outlines of a finch. Two of the birds are exactly the same, but offset. And the first bird in the row is nearly the same, but it's looking in the opposite direction. The outlines are loosely colored in by watercolor washes that doesn't try to stay within the lines. Under this is a little bit of handwritten text that reads, "With this wine, we express gratitude for our magical hillside, those who have helped fulfill its potential, and the friends and family with whom we celebrate life." Note the mention of the hillside. We'll be returning to that. On the back of the bottle is a simple black label, and it carries more of the information we need. The name of this red Bordeaux-style table wine is RDV Friends and Family, but I want to call it DeVinck wine. The RDV are the initials of the winemaker, Rudger DeVinck. It's not easy to buy a bottle of this wine. You have to either go to the vineyard or be on its mailing list, and the vineyard isn't easy to get into. You have to go by appointment for a tasting and a tour, and they're booked up on the weekends into December. So I'm going to run very quickly down through our 9 categories and the points I've given them each, and with a little bit of a description. Color and clarity right off the bat get 10 points each. Nothing wrong there. I give the aroma 8 points, although there wasn't anything very different about it. It just had a very nice wine smell to it. And the taste notes, this was delicious wine. I mean, I was impressed. Right out of the bottle, delicious. And to me, it had a raisiny kind of flavor. And for the taste, I gave it 10 points. We hardly ever give 10 points for taste to a wine. This one was so delicious, it had to get top marks. The feeling that tannins produce was totally submerged in this wine, which is kind of nice, that there was no bitterness. The body was medium to heavy, which is what I like, so we'll give that 9 points. The alcohol balance was beautiful. All the flavor was there without the experience of the alcohol taking your breath away. This is a higher percentage of alcohol, 14.5, than your average bottle of wine. That means it's blended very well. And we're going to give that 9 points too. The acid balance gets 10 points. Was not flat at all. Was bright, remained so. Okay, now the complexity and structure. This bottle was from 2008, and I read it should be consumed between 2011 and 15, so we followed the instructions. I can't tell anything about how it was fermented, whether it was stored in oak barrels or not. That I just didn't taste the woodiness that sometimes is a factor in wine. We're going to give the complexity and structure 10 points too. The price, if you could go into a store and buy this, it should go for $25 a bottle.
I definitely would buy this if it were available. And I intend to try to take a site visit to the winery. So anyway, the total score for this wine is 92 points.
So let me tell you a little bit about Rutger De Vink. And this information comes from a local magazine called The Washingtonian in their May 2012 issue. And I'm not going to read from it, maybe just some quotes, but I will just outline what it says. And it says that Virginians love their wine, and they've been trying to produce a great wine ever since Thomas Jefferson experimented with making wine, trying to match the quality of the Europeans and mainly the Bordeaux's. Thomas Jefferson wasn't able to match the wine, but this gentleman, Rutger De Vink, believes he knows the secret. The secret of making a great Virginia wine, he thinks, is drainage and rocky soil. We've talked about Maryland wines in the past and how there's just not enough stress on the grapevine to produce a good juice. So this is a similar problem. I'm going to read a little passage from the article to explain why drainage is so important. This quote comes from an article in the Washingtonian called "Virginia's Rogue Winemaker. Has This Man Finally Succeeded?" And the article is written by Todd Kleiman. Drainage is vitally important in a state that, compared with the meager rainfalls of California and France, is something of a swamp. That's Virginia. When De Vink began digging, a man in the crew turned to him and shook his head, saying, "I'm sorry, man, it's nothing but blanking rock here." But the site scientist De Vink had hired to oversee the digging just laughed. "No, no," he said, "that's gonna get you $100 a bottle."
De Vink has planted his grapevines on a hillside made of rock. So the water naturally runs away from the roots. And that's good, because you don't want the plant to have a reserve of water. If the plant has a reserve of water, it's going to try to make more plant instead of concentrating its efforts on the reproductive parts of the plant, which are the seeds and the grape. So not only does the water run away from the roots in this scenario, but they also plant the plants a good distance apart for more control. And they also cut back the plants to the minimum. Plant has no options but to put all of its energy into the grape itself, which is going to make a better concentrated juice. De Vink has really put a lot of thought into this, and from what I can taste in this wine, it's working.
In the article, there's a quote by a person called Luca Pascina, where he says he admires De Vink's devotion to detail and his willingness to learn and his drive to succeed, but he still says that we all know there isn't a great deal of difference between a $100 bottle of wine and a $35 bottle.
I think it's amusing that an area grower said that there wasn't that much difference between a $35 bottle of wine and a $100 bottle of wine. That makes me think I would never want to pay over $35 a bottle.
As I mentioned in the opening, this bottle came from M24. She's been out to the winery, and I think she said she took pictures of it, and it's pretty impressive, I guess. And they, when you go there for a tasting, you automatically are tasting the wine paired with something that they've chosen. And their website is www.rdvvineyards.com.
I'm pulling up my Bible app.
You have a Bible app?
Yes, I am a cuckoo. No.
Why can't they figure this out?
I don't know. This thing thinks I'm you and you're me. Keep your hands still. Hold on. There we go.
Now it's time for me to give the answer to the chapter and verse movie quiz for episode 23. Just to remind us of what that mystery film was like, here is a short clip.
Who is this man?
Major Danby, sir.
Danby, D-A-N-B-Y.
Take him out and shoot him,
sir. I said take him out and shoot him. Can't you hear?
Yes, sir. Take Major Danby out and shoot him.
I think you better wait a minute, Dad.
What?
I don't think you can shoot him.
Why the hell can't I? Why not? You mean I can't shoot whoever I want to? Is that a fact?
I'm afraid it is, Dad.
And the answer is Catch-22. Here are some quotes I underlined in the book that are typical Catch-22 nonsense. The colonel sat back when he had finished and was extremely pleased with himself for the action he had taken to meet this sinister crisis. Yossarian. The very sight of the name made him shudder. There were too many S's in it. It just had to be subversive. It was like the word subversive itself. It was like sedition and insidious, too. And like socialist, suspicious, fascist, and communist. It was an odious, alien, distasteful name. A name that just did not inspire confidence. It was not at all like such clean, crisp, honest American names as Cathcart, Peckham, and Dreidel. No such private nights of ecstasy or hushed-up drinking and sex orgies had ever occurred. They might have occurred if General Dreidel or General Peckham had once evinced an interest in taking part in an orgy with him, but neither ever did, and the colonel was certainly not going to waste his time and energy making love to a beautiful woman unless there was something in it for him. This quote is a conversation between Captain Yossarian and Milo Minderbinder. I don't want any 8-year-old virgins, even if they are half Spanish. I don't blame you, but these 8-year-old virgins are really only 32, and they're not really half Spanish, but only 1/3 Estonian. I don't care for any virgins. And they're not even virgins, Milo continued persuasively. The one I've picked out for you was married for a short time to an elderly school teacher who only slept with her on Sundays, so she's really almost as good as new. The hero of Catch-22, Captain Yossarian, spends as much time as he can in bed at the airbase hospital. He malingers in hopes of keeping out of harm's way. Yossarian is a bombardier. His commanding officer, Colonel Cathcart, keeps raising the number of missions his men must fly. Most squadrons have set the number at 40, but Cathcart pushes the number ever higher to impress the generals. The missions are very dangerous because the flak or anti-aircraft fire. All Yossarian knows is Cathcart is out to kill him. Catch-22 is a lot like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you've read Douglas Adams' book, you'll remember it begins with space aliens called Vogons destroying planet Earth to put through a space freeway. Both books immerse the reader in an absurd universe and make joke after joke until the punchlines begin to wear on the reader. Both stories also follow their protagonists as they travel far afield. Captain Yossarian travels as the guest of First Lieutenant Milo Minderbinder, who builds a worldwide syndicate from a simple arrangement with the colonel to supply the airbase mess with luxury food. Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22, has compared Yossarian to Candide or Alice in Wonderland.
In Catch-22, Yosarian is very much like Candide or Alice in Wonderland for the first half. Things happen to him.
I read the foreword to Catch-22 twice. One thing I like about the foreword by Heller is that he mentions what his critics have found wrong with the book. He notes that they say it's repetitious, monotonous, and its emotional tone is all over the place. Those critics are right. Still, yesterday as I was getting off the train, I saw the book in the hands of a fellow commuter. He was a young man, and I started up a conversation about Catch-22 while we walked from the platform. To my surprise, I was enthusiastic about the book. I couldn't say everything I thought about the book in such a short span, but I found myself, if anything, encouraging him to read it. He said the book belonged to his father, and that his father gave up on finishing the book. I understand it takes an effort. Now let's talk about the movie Catch-22. The screenplay for Catch-22 was written by Buck Henry, who has a small role in the film. He's Lieutenant Colonel Korn. Henry condensed the 61 characters in the book, many of whom are little more than a name, down to a tidy ensemble cast, some of whom are little more than a face and a name. Henry has said that he has the ability to write in any author's voice.
I am most successful making screenplays from books and plays, because I can write you a chapter in any writer's voice. I think it's something you can do or you can't do. It's like impressionists. They do it in spite of themselves. I can't do impressions, but then they can't write in other people's voices.
Going by the script for Catch-22, I would agree with Buck that he did capture the author's voice. The movie is very faithful to the book. In some of the banter between characters, this isn't a plus. Some of the exchanges are merely verbal tail chasing. The phrase Catch-22 has become part of our lexicon of ideas, and it's the most prominent of these infinity loops of dialogue. I would just say one per story, please. I want to point out that the film handles the story's non-linear narrative better than the original book. The way Heller talks about his writing process makes me believe he thinks the structure of Catch-22 is awesome, masterful on his part. He said, quote, "The feeling that you get when reading a piece of prose, fiction or nonfiction, and it's so perfectly organized and the words are just right, the feeling you get is that the author took no longer to write it than it has taken you to read it." I used to berate myself working with Catch-22, working only 2 hours a night and coming up with only one page. Until I started to be interviewed, and people who wanted to write said the same thing about me, that Catch-22 is so perfectly executed, it must have just flowed, it must have just come out of my mind. Catch-22 was 7 years of writing. End quote. The events in Catch-22 happen in orbits. They go by and come around again later. I don't see any trick or need for inordinate planning to accomplish this. The film, however, gives a rationale for the revolutions. They link the passes to Yossarian's unconscious. Something happened on one of the bombing flights that Yossarian doesn't want to remember. But in his dreams, he goes back to the painful mission over and over again until finally he remembers everything. This psychological component is missing from the book. The book is so filled with nonsense, the orbits are just more nonsense. While I like the film better than the book, there are some moments in the book that the film left out or condensed. For example, Chaplain Tatman in the book has a much larger role. He's powerless and basically harmless, but it seems like everyone persecutes him. The colonel at one point forces a piece of fruit onto the padre, and later he accuses the innocent clergyman of stealing it. The film references the fact that Doc Danica is mistakenly declared dead.
He's even standing next to his fellow soldiers and assures them that he isn't dead. But the book pushes the idea even further until it becomes really funny. We learn how much better life becomes back in the States for Doc Danica's wife after the Air Force treats Doc as dead. And Doc eventually comes to accept his own death and just hangs around the base not talking to anyone. Another comedic opportunity was missed by leaving out PFC Wintergreen. He's a mail clerk at HQ, and he's basically running the war. There are sudden tonal shifts in both the book and film. You're likely to get whiplash as the story shifts from nonsense humor to sudden death. I didn't really enjoy this. You could say that it bristles, and maybe that's the intent, but it seems arbitrary. I see it as an ingenuous attempt at adding weight or substance to a lighter story. What is Catch-22 trying to do? It isn't much of an anti-war book. Heller has said that he enjoyed his time in the service, and he never experienced the crazy stuff he put into the book. Now let's talk about the film director, Mike Nichols. After leaving improvisational comedy, Nichols moved from stage directing to film directing. He was heavily influenced by director Elia Kazan, who also worked in theater and film. Just from watching Nichols' Catch-22, I have to think that he had an experimental nature. If you remember last episode, he had that up-the-skirt shot, and he had the hand-over-the-lens trick. But what I didn't mention was he also used a cutaway view of the airplane cockpit compartments that reminded me of Wes Anderson. He also injected that psychology into the film structure, which is very important.
Look, there's only one question. What is this really like? And never mind, in fact, the script. When somebody seduces someone, when somebody kills someone, when somebody loses someone. What is it really like? And the only difference is that in a movie, the answers are less literal. Because what is it really like includes the unconscious and includes our dreams.
I vaguely knew of Mike Nichols as part of a comedy team duo, Nichols and May. My mother enjoyed them and remembered them appearing on an old TV show from the 60s called That Was the Week That Was. I remember her telling me about it. I don't have a clip from that show, but here's a clip of the Nichols and May doing a beer commercial. This is one in a series that they did.
All right, ladies, stick them up. Get your hands up there. Let's have your purse.
Here. Oh, yeah, would you like my wristwatch?
Yep.
It's 14 karat gold, the band is, and my earrings are 14 karat gold. But you have a cultured pearl necklace.
What do you got in that package?
It's just some Gansett. Just some Narragansett beer with that famous straight from the barrel taste. Narragansett lager beer, light but not too light. But not actually worth anything in cash value. Oh, don't take my Gansett, please. I'm taking it home for my husband's birthday party. Please, I don't have any more money to buy any more beer. I had to sell my hair to buy this. I need it very much. He's looking forward to his surprise birthday party.
Why, bless you, lady. I wouldn't take your Gansett away. Why, my refrigerator at home is stocked with Gansett right now. Straight from the barrel taste. I never go without plenty of Gansett in my refrigerator.
Oh, really? Then maybe we can have the party at your house.
Most of Mike Nichols' filmography is made of movies I don't care to see or films I wouldn't care to watch again. On my list of films I never care to watch again are Closer, Primary Colors, The Birdcage, and Working Girl. On my list of his films I wouldn't mind seeing again are Biloxi Blues, The Day of the Dolphin, and Catch-22. Probably his most popular film was The Graduate. I've seen chunks of that. I wouldn't mind watching the whole film. I'm also curious about his Carnal Knowledge. It has a young Anne Margaret in it, and that has to be worth a watch. So there you go. That was the answer to quiz 23. And on to our next quiz. even though the chapter for our next quiz is only 4 minutes in length, my description of it is going to go way longer than that. And I think this is because it's kind of complicated. It's got lots of parts to it. And the other factor is this is one of my favorite movies, so I did linger over the description quite a bit, tried to put everything I could into it. The room is dark. Two windows with swag curtains are visible in the background. The camera appears to be on the floor. We see part of the ceiling. A body heaves itself up from the floor. It's a man struggling to rise. He steadies himself on a padded chair and stands swaying in the middle of the room. He takes a step towards the windows. The camera cuts to the man entering another room. He flips on a light switch and braces himself on the wall. He stands in the doorway of a bathroom. His suit is rumpled and his short necktie hangs outside his buttoned-up, double-breasted suit. He staggers to the sink, turns on the tap, and splashes water to his face. He looks into the mirror and continues to press water to his face and forehead. The camera cuts to an empty room with a desk and phone. The man, we'll call him Dash, enters the room. He leans on the door jamb and picks up the phone. He dials a few digits. The camera cuts closer. He holds the phone to his head. The soundtrack music is soft and composed of strings and heavy vibrato flute. There's a large bruise on Dash's forehead. He grimaces and shakes his head a bit. He talks to his girl Friday on the phone and asks to speak with another woman. We hear a faint female voice say something. He's astonished to find out that the other woman is not with his girl Friday. The other woman, we'll call her Ruth, never showed up. Note that Ruth returns at the end of this chapter. Dash tells Friday to meet him at the office. He hangs up the phone and grimaces again. He looks angry. The camera pans down as he turns. It follows his hands as he searches the desktop. He opens a small container and flips through a fancy notepad. There's a wipe from right to left. A wipe is an editing trick that replaces one bit of film with another, without a hard cut. He removes the sheets from a mattress and turns it over. He sits down and touches a small brass basket that stands on the night table. Dash flips the lid of the basket on one side. It's probably a cigarette holder. There's an ashtray next to it. He looks down and picks up a newspaper, looks at the front and unfolds it. On the soundtrack, there's a flourish of brass instruments, trombone and trumpets. There's an insert shot of a hand flipping a page and a thumb holding a section of the paper. The camera zooms in to show that someone has penciled the box around an item in the shipping news. It reads, "Arriving today, 5:35 p.m., La Paloma from Hong Kong." There's a lap dissolve. This is an editing technique whereby the image of one shot is gradually replaced by the image of another. The newspaper fades, but the words La Paloma remain, appearing painted on the side of a ship. Flames burst from the left side of the frame. We hear a siren and see a fireman in a wet black slicker scaling a ladder. There's an insert of a large boat burning. The camera is canted. Moonlight plays over the black water in front of the ship. There is another cut to a group of firemen staring off the stern of a ship. Another fireman is seen climbing up the ladder against the side of the La Paloma. There's a cut to the dockside. Police stand with their backs to us. A line of firemen walk past pulling a fire hose. Dash follows the men and the camera dollies to stay with them. Dash approaches a group of men in sailor caps. He hooks one by the arm and turns him. He starts to speak, but the sailor motions he can't hear him. Dash starts again and yells, this time above the noise of the burning fire and spraying water. Dash turns around and starts to walk back the way he came. There's another optical wipe from right to left. The dockside is replaced
by an office interior. Dash's girl Friday is a blonde. She stands over Dash, who sits tilted back in a chair. In the office, we see a window with backwards writing painted on it. It advertises the office name to the street. There's a certificate on the wall and a globe behind a stack of fat books. Dash has removed his jacket but not his tie. He's been telling Friday about his comings and goings. She's dabbing at the goose egg bump on his forehead. They share a laugh but suddenly hear someone at the door. They look to their left anxiously. Dash sits up. The camera pivots from the two of them to the door. There's a shadow on the glass. A tall man in a hat pushes open the door. He's carrying a bundle wrapped in paper. He starts to fall to his right and bumps into a table. A small lamp pitches over. We hear glass breaking and Friday screams off screen. The tall man faces Dash but looks down at the floor. He wobbles on his feet. He holds the bundle low between him and Dash. Dash is frozen, just watching the new arrival to see what will happen next. The man says something like, "You know what this is." There's an insert shot of the bundle falling to the floor. The cylindrical bundle rocks slightly between their shiny shoes. There's a cut back to the two men facing each other. The tall man tips forward like he's about to fall. Dash remains frozen. The tall man seems to realize no one's going to help him, so he bends down and the camera follows as he falls slowly into a sitting position on a leather couch. The couch's back is even with the lowered camera. We now see only the tall man's hat over the back of the couch and the open office door. Dash moves to the man and tells Friday to lock the door. Friday moves into the outer office. There's a cut to the end of the couch. We see the tall man sitting in profile. Dash kneels on the couch and opens the fallen man's jacket to remove a wallet. He slides out a folded sheet of paper. It looks wet. The shot returns to behind the couch. We see Friday return to the room and she closes the inner door. She stares at the fallen man and puts a thumb to her mouth. She stammers, is he? Dash confirms her fears with a, yeah. There's a close-up shot of Friday. She stares stricken with fear. She squirms a little to the right and away from the couch. Dash says, he couldn't have come far with those holes in him. He stands up and the camera follows. He holds his hands stiffly in front of his body. His pants are pleated and a chain loops from his belt to the left hip pocket. He moves to a sink and washes the blood from his hands. Friday stands far left and looks off screen towards the body. She's pinching her right hand with her left. Dash begins to dry his hands on a towel. He says, why couldn't he have stayed alive long enough to tell us something? He looks over at Friday and she has closed her eyes and her head tilts. He moves quickly towards her. He takes her by the shoulders. He holds her up and she smiles even though her eyes remain shut. He says, here, here, you can't pass out on me now. He looks down at his feet. The scene cuts to show the bundle at Friday's feet. Dash's hands are shown lifting the bundle. The camera follows Dash's hands as he rises up and turns. It tracks with him as he moves deeper into the office and sets the package on a corner of the desk. The camera zooms out to a two-shot of Friday and Dash standing either side of the package. The desk lamps glow behind the bundle and the light is cast up into the couple's faces. Friday starts a sentence. Do you really think it's... Dash snaps open a jackknife. The camera changes to one positioned over Friday's shoulders, so we see Dash. Dash has a fanatical look as he struggles to cut through the wrappings covering the bundle. He tears into the wrapping, peeling it back. His left hand shoots out and grips Friday's forearm. He says, we've got it, Angel, we've got it. There's a cut to a shot over Dash's shoulder, so we see Friday's reaction. Friday winces with pain from Dash's grip. She says, you're hurting. The phone rings loudly. They're both next to the phone, but he orders Friday to answer it. She looks at Dash with her mouth open like she's never seen him before. She picks up the receiver and says, hello? Yes? Who? There's a small female voice at the other end of the phone, but we can't make out any words. Friday's eyes get very big. She looks at Dash and says very excited into the phone, oh yes, where? Yes, yes.
Then we hear a scream over the phone line. Friday says, "Hello? Hello? Hello?" Dash doesn't move. Friday hangs up the phone and tells Dash in a panic that the call was from Ruth. Dash asks where Ruth is calling from. Friday says, "Wellington, 36 Ancho." Friday pleads with Dash that he has to help Ruth and adds that Ruth's voice on the phone was awful and something was happening to her. Friday's really flipping out. She grabs up Dash's jacket and urges him to go to her rescue. Dash is slow to respond. Finally, the over-the-shoulder shot at Friday is relieved by a medium shot of the two facing each other. Dash says, "Okay, I'll go." He continues to give Friday directions. He faces the camera as she helps him on with his jacket. Now Dash kicks into high gear. He gives orders to Friday rapid fire. He buttons his jacket and she leaves frame and returns with his overcoat. Again, she helps him on with the coat. He picks up the bundle and moves quickly to the office door. The camera pans with him. He snags up his hat and positions the brim with his index finger. Friday holds the door while Dash turns back for one last group of instructions. He tells Friday to lock the door and wait for the police. Friday looks at the corpse on the couch and asks Dash if he knows who the dead man is. He says, "Yeah, he's Captain Jacoby, master of the La Paloma." Then he lightly slaps Friday twice on the upper arm and chucks her under the chin. He points at her and says, "You're a good man, sister," and walks out of view. She closes the door after him, following his instructions. Well, that's the chapter. Do you know this movie? I've seen this film about a million times. Each time I see something new. This time I'm a little amazed at the crap Friday puts up with. The biggest thing is she's obviously queasy and almost faints over being so close to a dead man. But Dash orders her to stay locked in the office with the corpse alone. This film is in black and white, and in the past I've noticed how sweaty some of the characters are, and some of the interiors look grimy. This is the first viewing where I've noticed Dash takes the folded paper off the body of Jacoby. It's the first time I noticed that the paper's wet with the man's blood. It's sticky, that's why Dash holds his hands out so they don't touch anything, and he washes them quickly. The actor playing Dash is doing a pantomime to make up for the fact that the camera can't show us the red blood. Listen to the next episode to find out the answer, if you haven't guessed it already. We'll talk about the book, a little bit about the author, and the director of this film.
Cream top, the new style milk bottle. From the same bottle, either thick cream or rich whole milk available instantly. When your milk is delivered in modern cream top bottles, you get something you can't buy from dairies. Economy. A pitcher of cream. Think of it. Real cream, not just top milk. Use it for coffee or cereal. Turn it into whipped cream for dainty desserts. That's luxury without extravagance. Protection. A daily guarantee of quality milk for children. Only rich whole milk can fill the upper chamber. So thick it whips stiff. Convenience. Either rich milk or thick cream. Available instantly from the same bottle of good cream top milk. You're always prepared for unexpected company. The cream is there. Efficiency. When you want cream rich enough to whip stiff, simply insert separator and pour. If you want milk, agitate the bottle normally. Because it guarantees these extra measures of service, the cream top bottle is the symbol of better dairies the country over. Something more than just a bottle of milk. Ask your milkman. Cream Top Bottle Corporation, 11 North Pearl Street, Albany, New York.